And good morning. You are listening to the 88.5 KRFY Morning Show. And I'm Susie Prez, one of your hosts this morning. And over there is my smiling co-host.
Hi, Susie. I'm Chris Bessler, your co-host. How you doing?
I'm fine. It's nice to see you on this morning. You weren't here last week, were you?
I wasn't here. I had the week off.
Well, lucky you.
Yeah.
And we have guests in the studio. You want to tell our listeners about that?
Yeah. Today we're going to be talking about climate change, specifically about the Paris Summit on Climate Change with Gary Payton, who's in the studio. Gary.
Good morning, Chris.
And
good morning, Susie.
And Susan Drumheller, who is with the Idaho Conservation League. Susan.
Hi. Good morning.
And Gary, you attended the Climate Summit in part as you through your work with the Idaho Conservation League, but also as a representative of the Presbyterian Church as well?
I did, Chris. I had the opportunity to be in Paris from late November through mid-December at the United Nations Climate Change Summit.
We're going to come back to that in just a minute. There's a lot of great information you brought. It's really kind of a rare opportunity for us here locally to have had that direct connection to basically a global event. With almost every nation represented on the planet. So that's pretty big.
Yep. We're really happy that you went there, Gary, and that you've come back to tell us all about it and your experience and kind of kept us connected during the conference, too.
So. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to our good conversation this morning.
Okay. It'd be great. But before we begin,
speaking of weather,
from the National Weather Service, currently it's overcast with 32 degrees. Today we can expect a 30% chance of snow showers, and it looks like about a half an inch will come in with a high of 34 today. And tonight, a low of 28 with 100% chance of snow. So there you go. So we might wake up to some snow, but it says little or no precipitation. Uh-huh. I mean, accumulation.
Yeah,
so
there wasn't much, but there's enough to make the driving very slippery. So be careful if you're out driving this morning.
Mm-hmm. And through the week, Wednesday through Thursday, our highs are hovering around 35 to 32 and lows 26 to 30. With slight chance of precipitation.
And also going on outside, the sunrise was at 7:34 a.m. this morning. Sunset will be at 4:14 p.m. And that means, now that we're past winter solstice, that we have picked up 10 additional minutes of daylight in the last week. So
we like that.
Yeah, we like
we'll
more
go with
light.
That.
The new moon was Saturday. It's now 8% full, and we'll have a first quarter moon this coming Saturday. Lake level is at 2052.84 feet. It's going to projected to hold right about there for this next week and for most of the winter, actually. Up at Schweitzer, despite the fact we had a little bit of snow, they're only recording, they didn't record any new snow. 1 inch of new snow in the last 72 hours. It's currently at 25 degrees in the village and 18 degrees on top. But they have a great base of 69 inches at the top. Mid elevation is 56 inches. They have all 92 runs open today with 7 of 9 lifts running. And out in the backcountry, the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center rates the avalanche danger as low in the Selkirks and the Cabinets. But they do caution that at the higher elevations, you need to be watching out for unstable wind slabs along the ridges. So if you are traveling the backcountry, as always, be careful. There's always some avalanche danger out
What's
there.
What's a wind slab?
Easterly winds might have pushed snow into slab-like conditions over the ridge tops. So if you're under the ridge, those slabs could break free and come down.
Oh, okay.
Happening around town this week,
lots of things.
Biggest thing that happened was the you got a new mayor sworn in, he started with a bang because there was
Good turnout.
There's a huge turnout because they were considering a resolution on refugees in town, and they had an overflow crowd. Apparently there were about 100 people that didn't even make it into the room because of the room capacity. They had over 150 people in the room. And the council is considering a resolution basically that says that Sandpoint won't discriminate as regards to refugees coming, being located here in our community. And of course, the county commissioners had passed a resolution previously that was supporting Governor Otter's position on this, which is that refugees shouldn't be located in Idaho. So we have two different types of resolutions in play here. The city council tabled their decision on their resolution, and they're going to take it up again on
I think the 21st?
On the 20th, actually,
okay.
Next week from this Wednesday. So we'll see what happens. And speaking of that, we're going to have the morning show next week. We're going to devote to the refugee question. Our new mayor, Shelby Ronstadt, has agreed to come in. We're asking one of the commissioners to come in, and we hope to have a civil and productive discussion mm-hmm. about the whole issue.
Get some information out over the airwaves about this issue.
You bet. From mm-hmm. two of the principals that are actually very involved in right. passing these resolutions. What's the purpose of the resolutions? Mm-hmm. What are their rationales behind putting these forward? Hopefully we'll be able to hear from those individuals, and hopefully our listeners will be interested in tuning in.
It's the goal of the morning show to inform and inspire our listeners, so here you go. And I want to remind our listeners, this is 88.5 KRFY, and all of our shows from the morning show are podcasted on our website at krfy.org. And so will this morning's interview with Susan Drumhiller, and from Idaho Conservation League, and Gary Payton. I guess we could get going on that interview.
Yes, we All have right. them here in the studio. Thanks again, Gary and Susan, for coming. And Gary, we're going to start with you since you're kind of the star here today. You're the guy that went to the UN Convention on Climate Change in Paris. Can you tell us what the event was about?
Sure. Let's back up a little bit and talk about process that the United States and nations around the world have been involved in for multiple years. The event was called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Conference of the Parties. So picking off that acronym, the Conference of the Parties, this was the 21st session of this framework convention that would have gathered on an annual basis across the last two decades. Most significantly, a few years ago, a previous event in Copenhagen in 2009, the nations of the world agreed that they would begin to work together in order to hold the increase in global average temperature to 2 degrees centigrade. All of the work over the course of the last several years has been building toward COP21 or this event in Congress, in Paris. A great deal of momentum during the course of 2015 leading up to this. Significantly, across the faith community, Pope Francis released a major encyclical, a teaching document in June of the year that framed the conversation about climate change in terms of not only the climate, the creation in which we live, but as well as the impact upon the poor. The Dalai Lama, a Tibetan Buddhist leader living in exile in India, has been an outspoken commenter as well on the issues of climate change and our human responsibilities. A major gathering of Muslim leaders in Cairo in late summer also added their emphasis from that global religion. In addition to the faith community moving these issues forward, each of the nations of the world was charged to bring into the conference its own plan on ratcheting down or dealing with the impacts of climate change in their country. Over 180 nations did so. So the gathering began on the 30th of November. The Monday right after Thanksgiving. The flow was really very interesting, Chris. On that Monday, 150 presidents and prime ministers from around the world gathered to kick off the two-week event. What was significant about that, not only was their message about our collective responsibilities to deal with climate change, but it was the largest gathering of presidents and prime ministers representing governments in history in a single place. That underscored the critical nature of the event and the outcomes of that event. The first week was dedicated to continuing work by a series of negotiators that were national negotiators from the 195 nations that were involved. They continued to work on the language of the draft agreement. In the middle weekend, it moved up a notch. It moved up to the ministerial level. So our senior representative became Secretary of State John Kerry. He was met with other ministers of state, foreign ministers, ministers of the environment from a variety of these nations around the world to work through in that second week. And then it moved to conclusion, where on Saturday, the 12th of December, the French foreign minister, who was the presiding officer of the event, hammered the gavel and announced the agreement that had been concurred in by the multiple governments. It was an historic gathering for the nations of the world. It was an historic gathering because of the outcome of the agreement in order to add momentum to the global response to climate change.
Do you feel, Gary, from having been there, that there was a sense of hope and that momentum that we talked about before you left when you were here on this to be interviewed really was there? I mean, you were kind of in the trenches, I'd say, with people on the outside looking in. And did you get a sense of hope from the people that you were with?
Absolutely, Susie. It was a very hopeful event. Hopeful because of that momentum that had been gained over the years and the reality of the attitudinal change on the part of governments as well as individuals around the world. Since that target was set in 2009 of not allowing the increase above 2 degrees C, there have been a series of catastrophic global events that have really focused persons' attentions. Whether it be the impact of Hurricane Sandy on the east coast of the United States, whether it be Typhoon Hainan and the great loss of life and destruction in the Philippines, whether it's continuing drought in Africa, or even for us. In my personal opinion, the massive wildfires that we experienced and lived through in Washington, North Idaho, and western Montana in August and September of this past year brought our awareness as well. We are all living in a circumstance where the climate has changed because of human activity. That momentum then brought people to the table with an enthusiasm to find a way forward, an enthusiasm to be able to gather the sectors of society that have responsibilities and can take actions. And so it was a time of hope, and I think we can move forward now concentrating on the individual responsibilities and actions that flow from the agreement.
For 150 countries, major countries, to come to an agreement, that must have had a lot of infrastructure happening during those 10 days, and I think a few extra days on the end to actually finalize the agreement in writing, and everyone signing it. I mean, as you said, it was a historic event, just in the infrastructure part of it.
Well, I've had the chance to participate in previous world gatherings, particularly organized by the World Council of Churches some years ago at a General Assembly. But I will tell you that never in my life have I been at an event that had quite the physical size and the scope associated with COP21. At the practical level, it's just kind of interesting to describe how it worked. The spaces were roughly described as the blue zone, where the negotiators were a variety of credentialed persons and businesses and government representatives, and the green zone, which was completely open to the public for additional conversation, advocacy, displays, etc. The physical size was overwhelming. The physical space associated with the blue zone, if we think of this as covered areas running from City Beach up to Fifth Avenue and Larch and Safeway and Super One, about that physical size, really, really an extraordinary arrangement. The facilities that the French government had set aside were at the La Bourget airfield. They have, over the last several years, created convention space within there. It could be physically secured because of security concerns associated with recent attacks in Paris, but the physical arrangement was really rather extraordinary.
And with the total number of folks that were there?
It was estimated that the numbers range between 30,000 and 50,000. So on any given day, my activities, I was staying in a small hotel in northeastern Paris. It took me about an hour to get to the conference site. It was a question of walking, riding the metro, riding a train, riding a bus onto the conference site that then went into the secure area, and then reversing that route at the end of the day. So the numbers were in the tens of thousands. The way that I describe the role that I had, I often describe this in terms of concentric circles. And it's important to note that I was credentialed and had full access in all of the aspects of the negotiations because I was credentialed as one of the representatives at the national level of the Presbyterian Church USA. So I was there carrying interests of the Presbyterian Church USA, as well as writing for and blogging for the Idaho Conservation League and other related environmental groups in our region that had an interest in COP 21. So being credentialed was very valuable. When I say that the process reminded me of concentric circles, at the inner circle were the negotiators. These were the representatives of the nations who have been working for months, even years, to be able to come up with the language. Those are the persons who were responsible for crafting the language. I view the second concentric circle as that of the scientific experts, the representatives of non-governmental organizations that had, and of the faith community that had direct interaction with the negotiators and could comment upon the way things were going, add their voice of advocacy in order to be able to continue to try to shape the outcome of the agreement. I view the third concentric circle as a group of informed citizens from around the world who knew a great deal about the issues but weren't necessarily immediately connected with the negotiators. I place myself in that circle of the third ring. And in the fourth ring, if you will, it's all of the rest of humankind around the world who is impacted by the results of climate change and are concerned about the actions that took place there. So the role that I took on was a role of listening, observing, and communicating, connected with those internal experts in the second ring, interacting with people there in the third ring, but ultimately through connections back here in Sandpoint and in the region, the written word, Skyping, etc., communicating back here what was going on.
Keeping us all here in the loop, so to speak.
Well, we had a very enjoyable event that the Idaho Conservation League put on during the midst of the event where I was able to Skype in the evening. We had about 70 people gathered in the conference center at the Columbia Bank to be able to provide an intermediate update. We have follow-on events scheduled, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Was there an opportunity, Gary, since you're there as a representative basically of both an organization and kind of a place, was there an opportunity for you to give feedback to some of the decision makers? Was there a formal process for that?
There were formal processes. The processes were regularly done at the national level through a series of panels, through a series of conversations. As an example, I was invited into a session where the U.S. negotiators were having a meeting with the representatives from the U.S. faith community. That gave us an opportunity for them, the negotiators, to brief us on how the progress was moving forward and for representatives of the faith community to add their emphasis on the things that had come off the table or that needed to be pushed further in the conversation. Generally, these dealt with issues of women's rights, human rights concerns, climate justice at large, making sure that some of that language stayed in the agreement.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the agreement, there was a obvious reason you've talked about it, why this climate summit even took place and how historic an event it was. But the outcome is this agreement. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it's going to unfold?
Well, I think the three major aspects of the agreement that we will continue to be working on for years are as follows. First of all, going into the agreement, there was the objective of being able to keep the average global temperature from not exceeding above 2 degrees centigrade or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. In fact, the agreement went further than that. The negotiators decided that they wanted to keep the rise, quote, well below that 2 degrees target, and in fact to aim further toward a 1.5 degree C or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit target. Now, this will be a significant challenge because of the amount of carbon that has already been put in the atmosphere across the last several decades. In fact, if all of the targets that were put on the table by the multiple nations were fully implemented, it would only draw average rise down to about 2.7 degrees C. Which brings us to the second major point of the agreement, and that is that nations will return to the table with new ratcheted down targets over the course of the next several years. So if you will, this is a part of that momentum that we were talking about. It was a step in a good direction, acknowledging that it is insufficient and inadequate to completely deal with the impacts of global climate change. But by ratcheting down the individual carbon reduction plans of the nations, by agreeing to meet regularly and bring that information forward in a transparent way, I continue to have hope that the global community is moving in the right direction. The third major point had to do with financing. It is a well-known fact that it is the developed nations which over the course of the last several decades have been most responsible for greenhouse gas emissions. And the nations who have contributed the least are the ones most affected, be they island states, be they states in Southern Africa, be they states in Central and South America. So the question of financing was on the table. And the major states of the world, the wealthier countries, agreed to continue to offer support to the developing nations in order to be able to reach a goal of $100 billion annually by 2020 with contributions to the Green Climate Fund. This will then go toward mitigation and adaptation over these next several years within these states most immediately affected, but those who have contributed the least to greenhouse gas emissions.
When I listen to what you're saying, I remember when you were here in November for a pre-conference interview, you talked about the returning to the table and how that was going to be one of the things you were going to look for. And when I think about returning to the table in 2 years, the good news in my mind is science can make a difference. When you think of, and you said all the things that we could possibly do right now will only bring it down to 2.7, I think you said, and we need to get below 2 because that's the goal of degrees centigrade. Science, you know, is constantly changing. So there may be things that come up in the future that will help meet those goals. Is that what you're thinking?
Technology. To help affect that.
Things we don't know about now.
Well, there was actually a side event which continued to add to that theme of hope. When Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg came forward and announced during the Paris gathering that they were launching the Breakthrough Energy Coalition. This coalition brings together a group of extremely wealthy individuals and organizations in order to invest billions of dollars in the next few years to accelerate the research and development for innovative clean technology. This activity happened in parallel to, on the outside of COP21, but it underscores that point that you made, Susie, that the science is evolving, the engineering solutions are in process and ahead of us, and ultimately there is hope that there will be a degree of breakthrough, whether using a single example, the ability to be able to have battery storage that can sufficiently store from solar and wind in order to be able to cover non-peak periods, etc. So that came out in parallel, and it was a significant activity from Paris.
Speaking on science, let's address the fact that there are folks that still are skeptical of the science. I'm going to kind of summarize what I think like the three main premises there are for the folks that don't feel that climate change is such an issue. Some of them don't believe climate change warming is even occurring, and others, if if they accept that that might be happening, they don't believe that it's human caused. And then finally, there's a group that contend that even if it is human caused, basically it can't be stopped. At least the economic costs of doing so are too much. Gary, how would you talk to these folks about the issue?
In my mind, Chris, the science is settled. There is no longer a debate, and I point to three convincing arguments that have brought me to this particular conclusion. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which consists of thousands of scientists from around the world, have the responsibility to be able to come up with consensus statements. Their consensus, as of a couple years ago, is that warming of the climate system is unequivocal, and since the 1950s, many of the observed changes are unprecedented over decades to millennia. The atmosphere and the ocean have warmed, the amounts of snow and ice have diminished, sea level has risen, and the concentrations of greenhouse gases have increased. Human influence has been the dominant factor. The second piece that convinces me on a regular basis is that these consensus statements have been endorsed by nearly 200 scientific agencies around the world. Scientific agencies, as an example, from every G8 nation, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, the UK, and our own National Academy of Sciences. The third point that underscores my conviction about the accuracy of the science has to do that the consensus statements are supported by independent review of the scientific literature. A couple of years ago, almost 12,000 abstracts of peer-reviewed journal articles across the last two decades were looked at. 97.1% of those papers supported the position that humans are the cause. So I understand the skepticism. At the core of the skepticism are issues of culture. Culture as it presents itself within the United States. So there are issues of peer pressure, there are issues of group identity, there are issues of political persuasion and ideology that influence a person relative to their interpretation of the hard science. I choose take in the scientific information and conclude that the science is unequivocal, the debate is over, and now the question is, how do we move forward as humankind to deal with the issues?
Mm-hmm. And actually, for some countries, this is basically a matter of life and death or existence. Some of the countries in Micronesia would have very low-lying land masses. They're just on islands, basically, and the rising sea levels are threatening them. Did you have a chance to talk to any of those folks?
Well, I did, that's one of the personal takeaways. I appreciate you asking me about the personal takeaways for me. I have, for the last two or three years involved in these issues, been speaking in future terms. I've been regularly lifting up the example and the responsibilities that I feel for my two grandchildren, who are 7 years old and 4 years old. My attitude changed when I was in Paris. My attitude changed through a conversation with a Mary Knoll sister, a Catholic sister from the Philippines, who had been directly involved in the relief effort associated with Typhoon Hainan, the massive destruction. That typhoon was amplified, I won't say caused by, but amplified by the circumstance of climate change. The increase in average global temperature means that around the world, the atmosphere is currently carrying about 4 to 5% more water vapor than it had historically. That additional water vapor means that the storms are more powerful when they do happen. I had the opportunity to interact with a group of young men and women from Southern Africa who had organized, in advance of COP21, a bicycle trip from Mozambique through Malawi and all the way north to Kenya. And along the way, these young men and women were having conversation with the negotiators from their particular state, with leaders in the faith community, with local elected government officials. Because these are people who are having their fundamental lifestyles altered by prolonged drought, the inability to have predictable rain when they plant crops, the dislocation from rural areas to urban areas caused by the impacts of climate change. All of these made it very real. And while I did not talk to him personally, I was able to watch repeated videos from the leaders of some of these oceanic states, ocean states like Kiribati, in the Marshall Islands and places in the west central and southwestern Pacific. These are small nation states, a deep historical connection built on atolls. They are today dealing with the impact of increased storms, rising sea levels. So for me, the story has changed from the future to recognizing the immediate impacts that people around the world, often the least of these, least capable of coping and adapting, are dealing with. And I draw that back to our situation here in North Idaho last summer, the reality of the impacts that we are beginning to experience as a result of these slow changes.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I think that's going to be a great point to come back to, is the local impacts and also how some of the issues that we're working on locally are affecting kind of this big global issue that's going on. And we are, to remind our listeners, 88.5 KRFY, The Morning Show with Chris and Susie, and our guests today are Gary Payton and Susan Drumheller. And Susan, we're going to make you talk when we come back, but I think we're going to take a break for a song here.
We have a song. This is Peter, Paul, and Mary, and the song is called Power. It's appropriate for our conversation, and yes, we will be back. So hear this. You can hear this song right now. We'll be right back. Peter, Paul, and Mary, Power. And that was Peter, Paul, and Mary, Power. We're here in the studios of 88.5 KRFY on The Morning Show with Chris and Susie, and our guest today, Gary Payton, who has just come back from the Paris Conference on Climate Change, and Susan Drumheller from the Idaho Conservation League.
And we've been talking about basically the global aspects of this. It's obviously a global issue, but let's talk about the way people can act locally.
Well, I guess that's a segue to me and some of the work that Idaho Conservation League is doing. You know, we have an energy program at Idaho Conservation League. We have a full-time staffer who works in Boise on energy-related issues. And but we also have some things happening up here in North Idaho, not just statewide, but also that affect us personally here, not just from the impacts of climate change, but the impacts of the fossil fuel industry. And specifically, I'm talking about the oil trains and the coal trains that come through here and the potential for many more of those trains to be coming through here. Recently, Congress lifted the 40-year-old export ban on domestically produced oil, and that could have a profound impact on us. We see a number of crude oil trains from the Bakken oil fields coming through North Idaho now. Those might be dropping off a little bit because of depressed oil prices. But once those markets forces change and the prices go back up and we've got this international market now for our domestic oil, we can anticipate seeing more trains coming through here. And these oil trains are particularly dangerous, the Bakken oil trains, because they're very volatile, they're very explosive, and they threaten not only our lives and our livelihood, but also our waterways and natural resources if we were to have a spill or something like that. Also, they impact us with the traffic. You know, we have a lot of crossings in North Idaho. Many of them are not protected with gates, and we don't have overpasses or underpasses to help deal with the traffic impacts of that, too. So there are a lot of potential impacts if these trains increase. And another thing that could generate more trains is a number of proposals to build terminals on the West Coast, mostly in Washington State. And there's a very large one coming up right now. The Tesoro Savage Oil Terminal is proposed for Vancouver, Washington, that would handle up to 360,000 barrels of oil per day. And that's about four long, mile and a half long or mile long oil trains per day, full oil trains per day. That would be coming through Sandpoint and through Bonner's Ferry, across the Rathdrum Prairie, and through Spokane. The permit is before the state of Washington right now. There's a draft environmental impact statement that's been out, and there's a comment period currently on that proposal, and the comment period ends January 22nd. There was a hearing last week in Vancouver. I believe there's one tonight, another one in Vancouver, and Thursday night there will be one in the Spokane Valley. So we are encouraging people to go to that hearing in the Spokane Valley on Thursday, and we're helping to provide carpools and rides from Sandpoint. We're working with partners around the Inland Northwest and the Pacific Northwest to help get the word out and coordinate getting people to that hearing.
And how would someone find out if they wanted to get into one of those carpools to go down to the Spokane Valley and participate in the hearing?
Well, they can call our office at Idaho Conservation League here in Sandpoint at 265-9565. You can also go to our website, idahoconservation.org, and we have an event on there under events, also under Take Action. You can get information about it. Probably some people who are listening this morning have gotten phone calls from us or from our partner organizations, or maybe they've gotten something in the mail. This is a big effort because this is the biggest of all the proposed oil terminals.
And the hearing's being conducted by the state of Washington?
Yes, it's the Energy Facilities Siting Evaluation Council. And this is a group that's appointed by the governor of Washington to advise the governor on whether or not to approve energy facilities.
So how will they weigh testimony from people living in Idaho? Is that going to be part of their decision-making process?
You know, I don't know what their rules are in terms of how they have to consider that information. But I think my understanding is that they are there to listen to what the impacts are of this proposal. And I think that what we do is we amplify the fact that whatever decisions they make in Washington State have impacts beyond their borders, whether it's in Idaho or Montana where these trains are passing through, or whether it's globally. I'm sure some people are going to talk about the climate impacts of burning all this oil. That said, I think part of it is just filling that room is going to have a big impact. And so we want to have a lot of people there. And they want to, I mean, the impacts that we're going to see here are the same impacts that they're going to see in Spokane and elsewhere in Washington State.
Because the trains go through Spokane metropolitan area as well. So,
yep.
You know, large population density where these trains that are basically rolling bombs.
Yeah.
With this highly flammable oil in them. Mm-hmm. And there have been some big tragedies.
Yeah. 47 people were killed in Lac Megantic. I don't know how to pronounce it very well. It's in Quebec, Canada, a couple years ago. And there's been other really pretty dramatic derailments and explosions and oil spills in rivers and waterways, you know, around North America.
Mm-hmm. Around the U.S., yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they're anticipating between Sandpoint and Vancouver two derailments per year as a result of this particular terminal. So the potential for accidents and that could impact our waterways or our lives and our first responders, you know, I mean, it's a big impact, and I don't think they can really fully address those impacts.
So just back to the derailments, it's not a matter of if they'll ever derail. They are derailing, and it's when, and increasing trains to four a day that are a mile long. And so what you're really saying is if without action, without people participating and having a voice, nothing will happen, but there is influence by showing up to this thing on Thursday night, this hearing in Spokane Valley.
They can't help but be swayed if there's a big turnout and a lot of people saying, hey, you know, we can't accept this. This is just too dangerous.
And why are, I heard that you're supposed to wear red. Just a little side note. What does that mean?
Well, it's kind of a, red kind of symbolizes stop, right? Green kind of means go. So I think that's kind of where the color came from. And so that began a couple years ago when there were scoping hearings around the coal export terminal proposals. And that's just kind of kept on with these hearings, that the opponents to these projects have been wearing red. And it makes a pretty powerful visual image for those folks when they look out across a sea of people that are all wearing red. And so that's why we encourage people to wear red.
Now, they've already had some hearings on this.
They had one last week, and I believe there's one tonight. Also,
and
in
what
Vancouver.
Kind of turnout and what kind of testimony are they getting so far?
They had over a thousand people at the hearing last week in Vancouver, and it was overwhelmingly opposed to siting the terminal there. I think they had some proponents there because, you know, basically they'll get some jobs in Vancouver out of this at the port facility. We get nothing out of it here in Idaho, nor does Spokane. I mean, they might get some, you know, indirect tax benefit or something in Spokane. But here in Idaho, we basically get nothing from this. We get all the risk and none of the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that's going to be Thursday from 5 to 11 p.m., if you want to go yourself, it's at 2426 North Discovery Place in the Spokane Valley. That's the Center Place Regional Event Center. There is a rally at 4:30. So we're going to have some folks leaving around 2:30 from our office so that we can be there in time for the rally. There's another group leaving from our office about 5:15. So if you're interested in catching a ride with us, give us a call at 265-9565 or go online and you can get the information off of idahoconservation.org.
Mm-hmm. There's other things that are happening with the momentum, as Gary talks about, to keep this going, and the whole thought of knowing what's going on globally but really acting locally. So if I was a regular person that wanted to know how I could get involved, what are some of the things we can do right here in Sandpoint to be involved? And you just mentioned a big one, because not only worrying about coal trains coming through our area, but keeping the fossil fuel on the ground is a secondary benefit to not having a terminal in Vancouver. But what are some of the other things going on and some of the groups that are organizing here in our area?
Well, there's a new one, 350.org, and this is a group that ICL's done a couple events in conjunction with. And that's 350.org is a global organization, and Gary, you might want to talk about it a little bit more, but a chapter has started here in Sandpoint.
So the chapter that Susan's alluding to is 350 Sandpoint. 350.org was an organization co-founded by one of the world's leading environmental leaders and writers, Bill McKibben. It's been underway for several years, and it has succeeded in amplifying the global movement and attention on issues of the fossil fuel impact around the world. So our local chapter is standing itself up, 350 Sandpoint. They have a website, and you can gain access to their newsletter list as well. And then the established organizations. Susan is here representing the Idaho Conservation League, that is currently deeply involved in the issues associated in North Idaho, as well as energy issues, particularly since the legislature began to meet again as of yesterday and the governor offered his State of the State address. The emphasis that we have here in North Idaho was first brought to our citizen attention by the Lake Pendere Waterkeeper. Waterkeeper organization is a part of a national and global organization dealing with water quality and water safety issues, not only in the United States, but around the world. So affiliation, observing the websites, following the activity, be it Idaho Conservation League, Lake Pendere Waterkeeper, 350 Sandpoint. These are all ways in which to stay informed and to find out about next steps. For us here locally, there was a unique opportunity while I was in Paris to be able to Skype in and provide an intermediate update what was going on at COP21. So we collectively are following that up with another opportunity. On Tuesday evening, the 26th of January, in the second floor at the Columbia Bank in the conference room, I'll have the chance to give another presentation highlighting some of the things that we've talked about this morning, as well as the impressions that I had. I'll bring in photographs and have a PowerPoint presentation to kind of give people a feel of what it was like to be there and what follow-on possibilities there may be for us. The original event that we had was midday. Many people could not attend because it was midday, so we scheduled this at 5:30 so that students can come after school, people can come in following a work day and share in this information.
Yeah, I think we're going to have complimentary appetizers at 5:30, and then we'll have beer and wine for sale. So it'll be sort of like a happy hour here about COP21. And if people have questions for Gary, that'll be a great time to ask those and learn more about that event.
Part of getting involved is being informed, and this event will kind of help with that process.
Mm-hmm. And 350 Sandpoint is specifically focused on climate change issues. Just out of curiosity, where does the 350 come from?
The 350 comes from the fact that several years ago, from a scientific perspective, it was judged that the Earth could continue to function as it has for thousands of years if the carbon content in the atmosphere does not exceed 350 parts per million. The 350 is well understood no matter what language one deals with on global subjects. Today we are in a place where the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere has exceeded 400 parts per million. It is advancing slowly, steadily as each year progresses. So as the agreement is acted upon, there is a goal, there is the hope that over time, over decades, that parts per million factor can be pushed down, with 350 parts per million being judged as the place where the Earth and all of its fecundity can continue to exist and support the life systems that have been present here for thousands of years.
And I know that 350sandpoint.org will be having events as time goes on to keep people involved and to inspire. I think you can go to info@350sandpoint.org and sign up, and you'll be on the list.
That's the email address you could use to sign up, but yeah, 350sandpoint.org would be the website.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're drawing near our time to close the show here. We are going to have some calendar items we want to go over because, of course, there's always a lot going on in Sandpoint. But Gary and Susan, thanks for coming in. Any last words that you would like to?
Yeah, I'd just like to remind folks that if you want more information about either the hearing coming up this Thursday on the Tesoro Savage Oil Terminal Project, or about our upcoming follow-up event on the Paris Talks with Gary, you can go to IdahoConservationLeague.org. And the follow-up event with Gary, again, is Tuesday, January 26th at 5:30 at the Columbia Bank Building. And that big hearing in the Spokane Valley is this Thursday. Thank you.
COP21 was a milestone, but it is now past. The question now becomes, where does the global community move forward? So actions are required at the governmental level. The agreement was negotiated at the national level, but states and provinces, counties and local communities have the opportunity to be able to move forward with energy efficiency plans. Businesses need to seize upon the opportunity created in the wind and solar area. There's profit to be gained from moving into this expanding business sector. There's a huge opportunity for young adults to be able to move into leadership roles. The gray beards, the gray-haired people who gathered in Paris that hammered out the agreement will not be the ones to implement the solutions. Those solutions will be brought forward by millennials and Gen Xers as solutions are developed and amplified in the 2020s and the 2030s and the 2040s and beyond. The faith community has responsibility to be able to lift up their moral perspective and find ways in which they can lead people into living lighter. And each of us as individuals has our responsibility and how we can consume less energy and how we can be supportive of the other sectors of society as we move forward and try to deal with the oncoming impacts of climate change.
And that could be as simple as turning off the lights in a room you're not using or skip driving the car to go 6 blocks to the store, take a walk. Those kinds of small decisions are very incremental in contributing to a less carbon use.
Sounds good. We really appreciate Susan and Gary for coming in. And we want to remind our listeners that this interview will be as a podcast on our website later on today at krfy.org. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan and Gary.
Should we have a song and then come back with a bit of information?
Yeah, as usual, there's a lot of things going on in town, so we want to alert people to those.
We'll be right back. This is the Kingston Trio. This land is your land.
This land is your land.